Welcome to, well, that fucked me up.
It really did.
A podcast with Luke Coulson.
And Kyle Wise.
And each week we're going to be talking to real guests about their amazing, often traumatic, life-changing events.
Focusing on stories of survival, hope, and overall triumph.
Which is flipping awesome.
Yeah.
Because we're all about that. We're all about listening to people's stories about adversity and trauma and crazy stuff. I think there really is something for everybody. There's many, many topics, many, many guests, people that really have got through some extraordinary things. Please share the love, share the show, get in touch, follow us, subscribe, click. We're trying to make it easy and open for people to discuss things that may normally feel tricky to do so. We've been on an extraordinary journey and we're glad you can join us. Enjoy the show. Welcome to another episode of Well, That Fucked Me Up. My name is Luke Coulson and today my guest is Danielle Patrice. Danielle?
Yes.
Did I get that right? Patrice. Patrice is your...
Yes, you did.
Oh, yay! Hi, Danielle. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Where are you calling us from?
I am from New Jersey.
Oh, nice. All right. Well, I'm in LA with my London accent. But I brought the London weather today. It's cloudy outside. So we're having a strange old year so far here in Los Angeles.
Well, you brought it here too because it's been cloudy and rainy.
God, I brought the London weather everywhere. Boo. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on the show. We're delighted to have you. And every week we have a guest who comes on and talks about their life-changing events and experience that they've been through. And it can be a one-off event, can be a history of experiences. It can be stuff you've learned along the way, can be things that happened in your past as a child, last week, can be emotional, physical. We've had all sorts of guests come on, from diagnosis to accidents to abuse to relationship to comas to, oh my gosh, I mean, just everything and anything. And what the common thread is the journey. The common thread is the journey through the experience and what we learned and what we can pass on to others, really, more importantly. And I think that's where you fit in quite well to this, because I know that there's a book attached to your experience. So with all of that preamble, Danielle, where would you like to begin?
Oh, wow. Let's see. After that amazing preamble, let me start actually when my mother passed.
Okay.
You know, and I think that's a big portion, because my mother passed 6 weeks after I graduated from college.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And
gosh.
Thank you. And, you know, by this point, and my mother had committed suicide. Oh. I found out that she hung herself in that with the scarf in the bathroom.
Oh, my goodness gracious me. I'm so sorry.
Thank you. And the reason why I always use that part, because it's a very poignant part from who I was to who I ended up becoming.
Mm.
And what I ended up started dealing with my trajectory in my life.
Yeah.
And part of that, I had already known my ex-husband. We were friends in college, but we were, at that point, we were just friends.
Mm.
But when my mother passed, and he was actually there for me, he was, you know, I consider him a friend. You know, we had our own lives, we had our own things, but I thought we were great, you know, a great deal of friends. And so when my mother passed, a lot of my family members came down. A lot of, you know, some of my friends that were in the area came to visit me, and he was one of those people.
Mm.
And the thing is that with my mother's passing, I was her only child as well. So at 22 years old.
Gosh.
So you can imagine that was a whole,
oh.
I mean, just everything, just my whole life turned upside down.
Yeah.
So for me, you know, having to deal with that, and then having to deal with situations where my mother worked at a previous company where they allowed me to have her, not inheritance, but they did a payout. And so there was a non-exclusivity clause where certain companies, if, you know, the person passes away during that particular month that they work, you can get a payout, but it depends. And if there's exclusivity clause, they could, you know, exclude, you know, suicide could be part of that exclusivity. So luckily, and I would say fortunately, I know that I'm just going to say a name because fortunately they're going on the bankruptcy, but Rite Aid was very helpful at that time. And so they were the ones that did the payout.
Wow, that's
And
incredible.
I was gratefully thankful for that because it was a non-exclusivity clause.
Wow.
And trying to figure out how to, pay for the funeral and all of those
Yeah.
things, it was very traumatic. So,
That's
the
incredible
load
that
I felt was
they,
like,
sorry to interrupt, that's incredible that they respected that and there was a payout in relation to that. And that's extraordinary that there's a, like a su by the way, suicide, death by suicide doesn't count. It doesn't allow you, the payout is extraordinary, isn't it?
You'd be surprised just finding all that information out. I mean, I
Yeah.
had no idea, but I had called and, just found out that information. And the unfortunate part was, even though, finding that out and letting relatives know, like, hey, look, there's money to, with this situation, I'm thinking, okay, now I can go ahead and figure out how to take care of her things on behalf, of my mother. And what ended up happening, that was one of my biggest mistakes because the handout started coming and said, oh, well, you owe me money for the funeral.
Of
Well, you owe
course.
me money for this.
Of course.
And then it turned into, you owe me money for my childhood stuff that my mother should have taken care of, and
Oh,
it was so much that I put a stop to
wow.
it.
Yeah.
And then, it was a lot of estrangement happening with my family members and including my father, who, pretty much 2 months after my mother's passing, saying, well, you need to move on. You need to get over it.
Oh my
So it was a
goodness.
lot of things like, it was just a crazy situation for me because, I'll say this, when you have your parents and you're under their, I'll say their umbrella, they're under their wings
Yes.
and you feel safe
Of
and you
course.
feel, the world is cool when you hear
Of
that. But then when
course.
to actually experience that, losing a parent, it's like no other. And so,
I have two sons, and I've always said like my role as their parent is to protect them, is to keep them safe
right.
and to let them know that I'm there for anything they will ever need. Like they, I am their protector. And I love what you said about that's kind of your parents' job. And as long as you know your parents are there, whether you're slightly estranged from them or you're at college or you haven't spoken to them for a while, you know your parents are there. And at that young age, at 22, to have your mom taken away from you like that. Now, did she have, not to dwell on this too much, and tell me if this is too personal a question, did you see this coming? I mean, were you close to your mom and did you see this coming that she was in that place where she was going to take her life?
I'm glad you asked me that. And honestly, I didn't know. And to be honest, my mother and I, our relationship was very fraught over
Right.
the years.
Right.
And a lot of it, my mother had mental illness over that time. And unfortunately, my mother did not, in my opinion, I felt that she there was something wrong. Like, there's something off. And I
Yep.
was always wondering, like, is there something going on? But it was never, diagnosed. And I found out after she passed that a little bit before her passing, she did go and get checked, and she had what was called paranoid schizophrenic. She was bipolar
Wow.
and paranoid schizophrenic.
Wow. That's a
And
biggie.
so,
That's a big one.
right.
Yeah.
So I had no idea over that time. However, I did find out, a couple months after her passing, a lot of things came out. And one of those things was my mother was telling them that she saw relatives who had passed
Wow.
already.
Yeah.
So, and then, she was, I guess there was different conversations about her telling them wanting to commit a suicide. And this happened, these conversations were happening over the time that I graduated from college. And I asked them, as my relatives, months after, I said, why didn't you tell me that she had these thoughts of suicide? And they said, well, we didn't want to bother you during the graduation.
Oh my goodness.
So it was like I would have rather had my mother than
Yeah.
don't worry about how I feel during graduation. I,
Yeah.
you know,
Gosh, it's
so
a shame that
yeah.
people knew she had those thoughts but didn't think to act on that, right?
Right. It's in this a way that I felt that, for me, we were in the same state, we were in the same town because my mother had moved from New Jersey to Nashville at the time and I was living out there. And I mean, even just the whole thing, like instead of me, how can I say this? It was more so, hey, Daniel, go visit your mom. Go visit your mom instead of sitting me down and say, hey, look, this is what's going on
Yeah,
here.
yeah.
It's a different type of
Of
conversation because at
course.
that time I was coming into my own
Yeah.
and I'm trying to figure out my way of living.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, no, you need to go be around your mother.
Yeah.
But not tell me what's going on, it didn't help the situation. So, you know, after my mom's passing, it definitely was a lot of blame, a lot of guilt, a lot of everything, I think, all the way around, because it was like, for me, I felt it was sudden.
Yeah.
You know, and now being thrusted into a world where I'm having to learn all these legalities, you know, learning what is the executrix.
Yeah.
How to handle her small estate.
That's such a huge burden on you. And also, there must have been some feelings of like, had you gone to see her, or was there anything you or other people could have done? And you have to get rid of that guilt around that, because there isn't, there's nothing, it's nothing to do with you, right? But I can understand where those feelings would have come from. But then to have all of the responsibility, the administrative responsibility, when, I guess when a parent dies, like my father died, but my mum is still alive and she's 81 and she's a spring chicken. And I honestly think she'll be here for at least another 20 years. But, you know, even when she says to me, my will is in this drawer and my bank account code. And I'm like, well, what, you know, what, why are you telling me this stuff? You know, she's 81.
Right.
But what we have to be prepared for that. And even then, it still seems like, well, how does that work? And how do you sell the house, or would you keep the house, or to exchange the bank and the thing? But 22 years old, with having absolutely no thought whatsoever that your mum was going to do that, must have been very, very hard for you.
It was traumatizing when I think about it, you know, because the thing was, you know, I love my mother no matter what, no matter how far our relationship was, I still love my mother. And I felt that, you know, when I heard how she passed, because I didn't hear it from my relatives, I heard it from one of my relatives' friends. Mm. So the situation was just horrifying for me, because it was like, hi, Danielle, I'm one of your aunt's friends. So tell me, did your mom have thoughts of suicide? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And that's how I was introduced to this woman. It's like, what are you talking about?
Oh my goodness.
I said, how did my mother pass? And that's how she told me. I didn't find out from my relatives.
Oh,
I didn't, you know.
Oh my gosh.
So from that moment, I was angry. I was very angry because I didn't know how she passed for hours. I think I had found out, I think at 4:30 Central Time, and then I don't think I found out till later that evening. So a good few hours. Mm. I had no idea how she passed. Nobody told me, none of, you know, and the anger, because I knew there was something wrong. I knew that there were issues.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wanted my mom to get help. And so it's like, screaming to the high heavens, and then all of this, you know, happens.
Yeah.
And now, I have to, you know, make all the funeral arrangements, you know, or not just arrangements, but have the final decision.
Yeah.
To do that, and still processing her, you know, her passing as her only child.
That's a lot.
Because she has siblings, you know, and it's different when it's you know, every death is hard.
Yeah.
Whether it's a grandparent, you know, but especially dealing with something like this with suicide, it's so sudden.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and the thing is, it's always like a before and after. Like, what was it like before?
Yeah.
Could things have changed before? And and you never really know.
No.
You know, and so, like, for me, you know, there was also a lot of things where she was also trying to get help for herself, what I found out later through her her medical records. And there was, I believe, some mixtures of different medication, where one was, you know, one for the bipolar. And then there was also a depression, and it seemed a little seemingly high. So, I mean, it was just a lot of different aspects happening. Mm. And it was just overwhelming for me, and a great deal of sadness trying to understand what happened to my mother, what happened during that final hour.
Yeah,
you know, for me.
Hard.
So. And I'm just to say, like, in just having the anger, you know, of everything of happening, that I wanted to go to grad school. I was a communications major in my undergrad. And so I was like, I was ready to go to actually go to California, get into, you know, maybe a grad school and with my father. And everything changed.
Yeah, of course.
With my mother's passing, everything changed.
Yeah. So what did that look like for you? What were the next steps moving forward from that?
So what ended up happening was I ended up, you know, getting closer to who is now my ex-husband, getting closer. And we actually, he was actually dating someone, and at the time I wasn't. And he's like, hey, you know, I said, you know, I'm going to move back to the East Coast, where I feel like I feel cared for. I feel like, you know, at least I knew people who knew me and knew my mother, as opposed to being around my family or being around my father or anything like that. So I ended up, you know, going up there to visit. And we end up, you know, he's ended up convincing me, like, yeah, you know, let's go to instead of you flying, because I was going to fly up there, why don't we drive and go on a road trip? And I said, okay, let's go on a road trip. And he's like, I'll, because his home state is like a few hours away from mine. Mm. So I'm like, okay, well, we'll go this road trip. Little did I know that I had found out from his cousin he liked me.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, and funny thing is, when he did meet my family, I found out later too that my father, he had peeped in and so, like, yeah, he likes her. So, talking about me. But,
and did you have any idea?
No, I didn't, because I was not looking at him in that way. I thought he was a really good friend.
Yeah.
But his cousin, she was like, yeah, you know, he likes you. And I said, really? Mm. You know, I guess he was a girlfriend. Yeah. No, he likes you. He doesn't want to be with her. He likes you.
Yeah.
So I ended up confronting him on the road trip. Uh-huh. And he said, you know, it's like, yeah, I do like you and whatnot. And, you know, he's like, I really haven't been with my girlfriend in this long time. I said, okay. Wow. So I said, all right, well, you know, we end up starting, and just, how can I say this relationship?
Yeah. Yeah.
And on this road trip. And it's, to me, it was like, okay, I felt like it was a whirlwind.
Yeah.
Because it was like, you know, he wanted to be with me. I remember a few weeks after, he's like, yeah, you're going to be the person I'm going to marry. And it's like, at 22, I'm like, oh my God, I'm going through this heartbreak.
Yeah.
And now I'm having this,
do you think,
this whirlwind of romance.
Can I ask a question, personal question? Do you think did it feel like he took advantage of your emotional state? Or do you feel like he felt like he really wanted, he really felt the way that he did?
At the time, I thought he did. Yeah. When I look back on that now, I definitely felt like it was grooming. It was taking advantage, because I was definitely in a vulnerable state.
Yeah.
I mean, for to be mourning, you of know. Course. And the thing is, I will say, when it started, it was 6 months after my mother had passed. Yeah. So it wasn't like right off.
it wasn't the day after tomorrow after she passed.
No, right, but, right. Yeah. No, but still, I mean, it's still, you know, I still feel like, yeah, because at the end of the day, you know, there's still a mourning, you know, time, you know, there's the same time heals all wounds, but, you know, it's still,
of course,
you're still healing, you're still grieving, and that grieving it can take a while.
Yeah, of course.
So, yeah.
So what happens next? You're on the road trip, the relationship starts.
So we started seeing one another, I would say for a good while. Fast forward, I ended up moving back to Jersey, and I would fly back and forth to Nashville from time to time. And, you know, and we had a long distance relationship, and that's where I ended up, you know, I got pregnant with my first son.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the thing was, what ended up happening, he ended up later on that year having his own mental health situation. And it was like a whole another thing happening now that's like, at this point now, I'm about to become a mother.
Yep.
I'm about to, you know, now I got to figure out how I'm going to do things. And he has his own situation going on. So I had to figure it out. I said, I need to get a job. I need to get an apartment and need to get a house, or I need to get a car, because I was back in New Jersey at this point and full, like, permanently. And that's what I did within 7 months. I made sure I had a job, had a car, I had and I had everything ready, a job, car, an apartment. Yeah. Everything ready so that I could get prepared for being a mother at that time.
Yeah, and had he, with the mental health issues, had he kind of clocked out of the relationship at this time, or was just just distracted?
We were still in touch. We were still together, but it was just like, he was doing his own stuff. I try not to get too deep into
this. I understand. We don't need to talk about it if you don't need to.
Yeah.
That's fine.
But then after that, yeah, everything kind of started, you know, hitting fast for me, because it's like, now I'm about to see myself as a mother.
Yeah.
At this point. And he ended up, actually, before I had my son, he ended up moving up to New Jersey, and he moved in with me in my apartment. And, you know, then I think I had my son in 2010. And so, like, you know, I had actually, this apartment I'd gotten, it was through this woman who, she was a pastor, and we had multi-mutual family members. We shared family members because of her daughter and my cousin have children together. So that's, you know, so she knew me, knew my family for years. And she, you know, allowed me to get an apartment under her, on her properties, which I was thankful for. And that time he moved into that apartment, and I was able to have, you know, this family.
Yeah. Wow.
And then and so I remember that a few months later, she said, you know, because we had talked about actually getting married. he said, look, you know, you guys, y'all been living there for a while. Let you live there while you know, you had your child, but y'all either got to get married or he's got to go. Because I don't believe in shacking up.
Oh, wow.
So.
Because she was religious. She was a pastor.
Right.
So she gave you an ultimatum, which is like, get yourselves into the Christian way of living or get the fuck out of my place.
At least him.
Okay.
You gotta go.
Wow. Right. That's.
And so.
Gosh. Amazing.
Yeah. So you know, I said, you know what? Okay. Well, we're just going to go ahead and we're going to get married. And I think, and a lot of stuff, you know, I've, you know, because it's like, it was a lot of back and forth trying to figure out where he was mentally, where I was, where Art and where we actually connected. So we did get married in 2010. And I will say the first incident, because even that relationship, even though we were together, it was still a lot of emotional situation, like emotional, you know, with him and I and myself. Sure. And, but I will say the first time that the night before we got married, I remember us arguing and have this, I don't even remember exactly what it was, but I remember him telling me, or pinning me down, He said, I can do whatever I want to you now because you'll be my wife.
Oh, no.
This is the night. And I'm just like terrified. I'm like, how am I going to get through this? My wedding's the next day. And basically he's already revealing himself.
Yeah.
And it was even harder to get out of even before, because even though he was like verbally and emotionally abusive, it was like, I know for myself, I wasn't strong enough to get out of that situation or how to, because the person that I was before, I felt I was stronger before my mother passed.
Yeah.
Wasn't there anymore. I was broken.
So he'd been emotionally and verbally abusing you up until the point where you guys were going to get married anyway.
I say off and on. I think that it was in my opinion, because part of that, I believe that was part of his breakdown, but sure. I also feel like I thought things were better. We're getting better.
So,
and then, you know, but.
So this is the first moment of essentially physical abuse, and it's the night before your wedding. How is that making you feel on your wedding day? Did you manage to brush that aside, or was there just stuff going around your head like, what the fuck are you doing?
A lot of things went through my head, because it was like a lot of emotion for one, but mother's not there. You know, a lot of family members at this point I'm still estranged from. And, you know, and then to have that situation, I'm trying to put on that brave face, like, oh my God, I'm about to, you know, marry this man and this is what's happening. I didn't know how to get out of it, because I felt, in a way, I felt trapped.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, it's different if you don't have a child. I have a child at this point. You know, it's like, that's his father. How am I going to get out of this?
Yeah.
And so I went through it. I went through with it, and you know, we got married, and I remember having that, you know, at the reception and into a restaurant and him. And it was like, you know, like put on a brave face, like, you know, maybe this is going to work out there. You know, but then 3 weeks, another situation happened, was after the marriage. And it was where we were arguing about something. And I remember him walking out of the bedroom to the kitchen. And I remember him running out of the bedroom after me and just pinning me against the wall and ripping the left side of my shirt. It was my mother's shirt.
Oh, my God.
And it was those kind of things that was happening over time. It was, you know, the headbutting.
Oh,
it became the, you know, the arguing. It became so much of everything. And then on the flip side of, even though I knew the people that were organization, the past and everything, that one thing I didn't say was that there was bad blood with some of my relatives and this pastor's family because of, you know, sometimes relationships don't work out. Sometimes things happen, and there was some bad blood. And I think in that sense too, my ex-husband also fueled that. There's a few things I will say, and I forgot to mention one that when before we got married, before he had gotten sick, my ex-husband had asked my family for their blessing.
Right.
One of my relatives said, "I'm not going to give you my blessing because Danielle has business to handle," and that was part of that was the money.
Wow.
That I was owing them.
Wow.
Other part of it. And so they're basically just destroying my character, talking about me as a. So that was part of the ammunition. The other part of the ammunition was some of these people, because there was bad blood, I believe a lot of them, what I found out later was that they were talking about, oh, well, her family's like this. Oh, if she's like this, oh, then her family's like that. Her family does. God. So it was a lot of behind the scenes, back talking. Yeah, it is.
Wow. Yeah. God, that's a lot, isn't it? So how long did the marriage, how long did that go on for? Obviously, you've got a new child at home with you while this stuff's going on. I'm assuming the child was too young to realize, but obviously,
absolutely,
thank goodness. But how long did this go on for, and what's going through your head when this is escalating and becoming a regular thing? So it's terrifying.
It was just, I mean, aggravating, because I felt alone. I felt like, and the thing was that my husband, in a way, I felt like he kept like his family to like before. I would say this, before we were married and before I even met his family, he never really talked about his family, not think about it. You know, he kind of kept them on the back burner. Yeah. It was almost like he could have he could be whoever he wanted to be. But when you actually met his family, it's like he had this big family. He's a well-to-do family. And it was nice to see that for him, but it's like the way that he portrays himself was completely different.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to have the, you know, like the tough guy facade and the image. But when it comes down to it, it's, you know, you have a nice, you know, a well-to-do family, like you don't need to put on a facade.
Totally.
And that's just my opinion. So I felt with him, you know, all of this, the dominance or trying to, you know, create this power dynamic over me. Mm. It was, I'm just frightening, because I never felt so, I've always felt safe.
Yes.
And this was the first time in my life that I didn't feel safe and didn't know how he was going to be, didn't know if he was going to protect, didn't know what to what, you know what I mean? Like, so I think that for me, it was just trying to survive on my own, trying to figure things out and still be a family with a child. And it would end up happening was that because my ex-husband was so, you know, candid with, you know, the people in the organizations and whatnot, that they all suggested, well, hey, why don't you go get a restraining order against her? And she's like this, go ahead. And so they ended up getting a restraining order. And I always talk about this story because, you know, when you get a restraining order, especially in Jersey's very powerful when it comes to restraining orders.
Yeah.
First person who gets a restraining order, so it's first come, first served.
So why is he getting a restraining order against you if he's the one who's causing the issues?
Well, it depends on what he says.
Oh, it depends on what he tells.
So, you know, and that's the thing, us fighting back and forth.
Yeah.
And then so it becomes messy. And that's the thing. And so, yeah, so then he's able to tell his side that, well, she's doing this and she's doing X, Y, and Z. Mm. And the thing is, do I fight back? Absolutely. But am I trying to sit here and start this, initiate this? Mm. Or am I trying to defend myself?
Yeah.
You know, and I think, and that's what it boils down to. And so I think with this situation in the first restraining order, you know, in New Jersey, you know, if you file first, you get the house, you get the cars, you get the kids,
goodness.
You get all of these things where the other person who doesn't have the restraining order, they'll end up they have to go live somewhere else. You get a police escort or to get to your belongings for like 15 minutes and then you leave. And so that's what ended up happening. And then that's how I, for a number of years, having to deal with relatives or going back to my relatives because not knowing what else to do.
Wow.
So, but I will say there was a particular court date and having to deal with all of this. And there was a woman out here, and I always talk about her, I always pray the name of Miss Sue. And she was I wouldn't say she was director, but she was involved in the domestic violence division at the Superior Court. Mm. And what she did, you know, she was my advocate, my first advocate. And she saw what I was going through. She saw that the fact that, because, you know, part of it is he left and disappeared for 4 days with my son, and I had no idea where my child was.
That's no good.
So until we went to the court and trying and navigating the court is very scary, especially as a victim of domestic violence.
Yeah.
So trying to understand. So when Sue came to my rescue and she's like, okay, you're a domestic violence survivor. Or victim at this point, you know, you're going through this. This is what this looks like. The first thing you need to do is to say that to level the playing field is to have a restraining order. against him, because you can you can fight it easier when you have a restraining order, and it's, you know, counter, you know, counterclaims, as opposed to him having the leverage over you. And so when she was able to do that, and I also explained, like, I'm the main caregiver here, so him having my child for four days, I mean, this is insane. And so she called his mother, because I didn't give them, she said, you know, your son, or you have till 7:30 that night to bring that child back, or you will be in contempt. You will get arrested.
Right.
And my son came back at 7:30 that night.
Wow.
And so it was, it was frightening. Just having that experience.
Yeah.
And that was within the first year of our marriage. The first year. And so that was what our relationship was like. And I ended up having my second son in 2013. And it was still, even with that, it was still ongoing.
Right.
And it was the lies. It was,
so you had another child with him?
Yes.
Even though all that stuff was going on?
Because, yeah, because it was, it's, absolutely, because it was on, it was off, it was, you know, there were good times, there were horrible times.
That's...
And trying to figure out how to make things work, and,
that is tumultuous, and I guess you thought a second child might help things, right? And I think that's...
No, not absolutely. And, you know, the thing was that I want to say, I feel like my second child was my surprise.
Yeah.
You know, he was surprised. And so, but for me, it was for the, how can I say this? For the relationship or the marriage, let me just say this, marriage I came into was like, okay, you know, even if he's this way, I want to help my family. He's part of my family.
Right.
And, you know, for that, you know, then he's my, you know, my husband, he's my son's father. And I want to make sure that, okay, if I'm dealing with this, we're all dealing with this. Let's get him the help he needs.
Yeah.
That's how I dealt with this situation.
Yeah.
And then, and I say I paid a very high price for that, for that thinking, because of everything that I endured throughout, say, we were together from 2009 to 2018, when he, and I'll just say, he had abandoned the family, left us destitute, left us homeless.
Gosh.
And when, and, you know, we end up filing for the divorce, and it finalized in June of 2019. So throughout that time period until 2018, it was more so about, okay, I want to help my family. I want to help my family, trying to make this work, trying to make this traditional nuclear family work. And the reality was, it couldn't work, because it would get worse every time.
Wow.
We would separate, we would come back together almost every year, and the situations, I mean, the arguments and the fights were gotten worse. I
and
mean
then
to
you've
the point
got,
where he
go on sorry
I mean to the point where, you know, it won, he did have a knife against my neck.
What?
You know? Yeah.
Oh,
and threatened to kill me.
And you've got the kids there now. The kids are getting to an age where they're aware of this stuff happening, are they?
My youngest one doesn't have memories. My oldest one has some, but it's not. But that particular incident, they were not in the room, thank God.
Wow, God, that's so scary. What? And you don't go to the police with stuff like this. Was the, because you guys had restraining orders and you went to court a few times, but were you guys calling the police on each other?
Yeah, I definitely was calling the police. And but one of the things that he would do was he would hide my phone. He would take my phone from me and hide it.
Oof.
If I called.
Oh my God.
He would, you know, the particular with the knife incident, he, when I ran to the door and I saw the knife, he grabbed and yanked me by my collar, and but basically I fell down and he locked the door. When
that's
he had the
terrifying.
Knife to my neck,
that's
you know?
Terrifying. I mean, it's like a horror. It's like a horror movie at this stage. It's like a bad movie.
It was definitely like one of those Lifetime movies you watch on. You know, it's one of those, and I felt like I was in that literally because it was like, what the hell am I dealing with? What is going on here? And with me, it was, you know, trying to have to be calm in that situation. Like everything just had to be calm because I don't know where his mindset is at this time. And, you know, and so for me, when he finally removed the knife and I pushed him as far as I could, and then he gets another thing, like an iron, where you iron your clothes, to try to bash me in the head.
Oh, my God.
And I ran out the house. This is the dead of winter in January with no shoes, no socks on, no jacket. I'm running for my life. And I remember hearing some go zigzag, and I ran zigzag on the hill and he fell. And I ran to my friend's house from high school, who's actually in the same complex as I did. And I did call the police, you know, constantly. But, you know, the thing is that certain police don't understand domestic violence. They might understand, you know, you hear about it, but you don't understand the experience. And my ex-husband was a charmer. He would play gospel music in the police station. Or he was such a charmer that particular night, there was a third party. And the third party ended up letting them know that there was no knife.
Oh, my God.
So they believed the witness over what I said.
Oh, my God.
So he was able to get the restraining order first. He, you know, put a bunch of lies in the restraining order. You know, he was able to get away with a lot of different things at that time. And, you know, even, and I'm saying this, now the last time I say this, and this was the 2018 one, which is so important because, you know, this is where my turning point, because I went to everyone. I went to his family, and they were, it's, even though I talked to him, it was still, it wasn't the help that I needed. I went to my family, that sometimes it made it worse. I went to a lot of people to ask for help. I went to police, you know, DCP, I mean, everybody out here. And it just, I felt like I couldn't help myself get out of this. I didn't feel like anybody could help me get out of this situation. Yeah. And this was before COVID. I mean, I felt trapped, you know, before that. And so, but in 2018, he had my oldest son out till 4 o'clock in the morning. And of course he was doing what he had no business doing. And so he, you know, got into an argument when he came home, and, you know, I remember confronting him, like, clearly you're cheating and whatever. And my youngest, who was four at the time, he woke up because he heard, you know, pretty much the commotion. But what he found was he saw his father pinning me down on the ground, because that was one of his go-to moves. Yeah. And my son, I told him to stay back. He said, stay back. And, you know, I didn't want him anywhere near there.
Yeah.
And so he saw this. And the thing was, he, you know, even when we were arguing in the midst of all of this, you know, it was like he was trying to raise his hands to be lifted, you know, up. It was almost, I felt like it was almost his way of de-escalation.
Heartbreaking.
And then I would say that poignant point for me that was saying enough's enough was he ends up saying to me, he said, I can kill you with my bare hands. And he's making this gesture, hand motion gesture in front of me, my son's right next to me, and then someone else. And my son is staring at him, and he says, I can't do it because he's watching me. And I said, okay, that's it.
Yeah.
To me, that was it. I said, I don't care about the quality of this marriage. I'm done.
Yeah, now it sounds like he's actually legitimately going to kill you at some stage. So you need to get the fuck out of there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And now I was just done. I said, you know what? If I couldn't, because I felt like my son was my hero, like my protector at that moment. It's like, you know what? If I can't get out of this for myself, I'm damn sure going to get out of here for my kids.
Yeah.
And I had to make sure that, you know, that next day, because it was a Sunday that day, I'm like, I got my final restraining order, which was my seventh. Like my final restraining order. Then a month later after that, I filed for divorce. And I'm like, I didn't have any money, but I was going to learn the legalities. I was going to learn how to get my divorce. And I did my own divorce by myself. Wow. And, you know, we, you know, went through being homeless, living at the bottom of a basement, my two kids, of a business. And we found amazing people who helped us, different organizations who helped us. I mean, just amazing people who knew what we were going through and were there. And to get us into transitional housing. So for me, this story, it was like, at some point, it had to become self-preservation.
Wow, that's... and he didn't come for the kids at any stage? He sounds like he ran?
He ran. He told my son, he's like, I'm going to be gone for a while. And he ended up being with his mistress. And what took place was we found him. I don't want to say found him, but... A year later, we saw him. I was on my way home, and he happened to just be out and about, like he wasn't with no care in the world.
Wow!
And I just remember that that initial reaction. It was like almost a year to the day, and it was just like, "What the hell?" And I remember just screaming out so loud that he heard me.
Yeah.
And then he comes to my car. He's looking. He comes to my and he sees my kids, and he's like. Now, keep this in mind. I still have my restraining order.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's trying to have this interaction and he's trying to talk to me and whatnot. And, you know,
That's...
I would say for me, it was terrifying because it's like, how did... Being back in this mode.
Yeah. And also, like, he hasn't seen his kids for a year. Like, where did he go? You know?
I know he was in a lot of stuff. I know that. But I will say that, you know, and I remember saying, I said, you left this family homeless. He's like, well, I'm homeless. because what ended up happening is I found, I think around that time, there was some article where he was homeless as this homeless crusader.
Right.
You know, talking about being homeless and, you know, and him and the mistress were homeless. And it's like, you know, it, to me, was almost like karma.
Yeah.
Because you put your own family in this situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now you end up, you know, and so he ended up, you know, I ended up filing a violation of the restraining order because of that situation. It's like, you know, I'm not, if you're homeless, you're looking for a place to go.
Yeah,
there's
course.
A place.
Yeah.
There's a place, there's three hots in the cot, you go over there.
Yeah.
If you want a place, because at this point it was, I was done with him.
Oh,
I was done with his family. I was done with everything because so much hell that my family had been dealt with.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, don't come back, because the only reason why you're coming back here is to find a place for yourself. And little did I know that, you know, who knows what you're doing out here. I don't want any parts of it.
Yeah.
I want to make sure my family is healthy and my family is safe.
And not good for the kids probably to even see him after a year. Did that fuck them up a bit, do you think?
I think, you know, I don't know, but I think that my older one may have thought that, you know, he was going to come back.
Yeah.
That's tough. 'Cause I remember he told me, he said something to him. He said, you know what your son told me? I said, what? He said, don't screw up this time. Because it was an on and off type of situation.
He was coming back.
But I think he thought but you know, my thing was, it was done, and I didn't let him know. I didn't let my son know that, you know, no, this was done because he wasn't supposed to be around. But the fact that he's coming over here, coming, you know, bombarding me and while I'm at a stop sign or stoplight, it's, and trying to force me to talk, it's really it was something else. Let me just say that it was really something. And I think that, you know, the hardest thing is that my oldest, he has the memories, and he loves his father. He loved his father, and the thing is that the hurt that not only did he cause, you know, me and my young one doesn't have the memories. Let me say it like that. He's my ex-husband, so I mean, I can always get another. So that's nothing, but you know, he has the memories, and he was closest to his father.
Yeah.
You know, and so he's his father's namesake. And the thing is that they had a lot of things in common, and you know, it's how do you rectify that?
Mm.
How do you rectify the damage?
Mm.
You know, and so that's, so for me now what I do is always encourage my children and let them know that this is a free space. You have every right to miss him. You have every right to love him. You have every right to care for him, pray for him, whatever, be angry with him. Whatever you feel, you have every right. You know, and at the end of the day, I'm always going to be here for them. I'm always going to be here. And, you know, and the thing is that they have any questions, I'm here for them.
Yeah.
Because I don't want them to feel like they can't talk about him. And oh, I got to be quiet because I don't want to hurt mom's feelings.
Of course.
It's not about my feelings. It's about you.
Yeah.
And about how you are dealing with
this. Yeah, that's amazing. So conscious of the time, we've got a few minutes left. Let's talk about what you're doing now. Let's talk about the the breakaway from that and the few years that after that up until now. What's that journey been like?
So I will say during COVID, I was able to get into an online research academy where I had an amazing mentor, Isabella, and where she was allowed, you know, to teach me, you know, guide me how the scientific process works. Because I wanted to understand the brain and understand what happened to me during the domestic violence situation.
Oh, wow.
And so what I did was she, you know, showed me, you know, researching scientific literature. Doing, you know, research, how to collect data. And so that was part of that was interviewing, you know, like a police officer, interviewing children, interviewing psychologists, sociologists. So all these people just to get a roundabout answer on not just the victim being a victim or not just having to deal with an abuser, but what does it look like from people who indirectly deal with the situation, whether they're social workers, whether they are, you know, CPS workers, and with the police. And, you know, seeing my research and, you know, and adding my own storyline, you know, of what happened, it was like I felt that the information was so damning that I wanted to turn this into a book, that I felt that people needed to understand this is what domestic violence looks like, not just from being a victim, but being, you know, what happens in the brain scientifically, what happens with the emotions, what's the power dynamic between the victim and abuser, introducing characters of like the victim defendant, talking about enablers, talking about how children, how they feel, all the way to entertainment, how, you know, with Congress, with their, you know, their statement may be about domestic violence, and all the way how society views domestic violence. So
that's amazing.
It's a roundabout thing.
This is not a question you can answer in one sentence, but is there like a commonality then in abusers? Like, is there like one trait that's just like super common? Is it people that have been abused? Is it people that, or is it just, is it really random in how one becomes an abuser within a relationship or with a home environment?
I think that, you know, personally, it's a combination of so many things. I think it's as complicated as complex as a human being itself.
Yeah.
Because the thing is we have, you know, learned behavior, external behaviors from, you know, different aspects of where we live, how we live, you know, what the family home life is like, what the genetics are. Is it nature versus nurture? Is it socioeconomic? It's so many avenues of the abuser. However, I do feel that there needs to be more information, you know, research with that. But also, you know, parts of that will say that also if there's any damage to the brain, if there's any possibilities of damage with the brain, it can alter and affect someone's behavior, their personality, and increase their ability to be more violent.
That's so what's your book called and where can we find it?
It's called Neuroscience, the Ecosystem of Domestic Violence. It's online on Amazon and BarnesandNobles.com.
How do you feel about the fact you've written a book?
I feel very proud. Yeah. I feel like I'm excited, you know, because it's, you know, it's one thing when you say I'm working on something, yeah. You know, you want to get it to fruition, but to cross that finish line, it's like, oh my gosh, like I actually.
And Barnes and Noble too, huh? That's pretty impressive. That's cool.
Well, it's online. It's not in the store yet. I hope one day.
Hey, all the stores are closing down anyway. It doesn't make a difference. That's absolutely incredible. And who's the demographic who people who have experienced abuse, but also people who just want to understand it more?
It's for everyone. I say over 18, because, you know, everyone, I'll say this, if for, because this is women victims, men abusers. My thing is, you know, one day you have, like you're saying, your mother, you have siblings, you may have cousins, you know, who are women. And the thing is that you want to know what happens, because one of the things I will say is that, you know, there's a situation where, you know, trying to get your friend or female woman friend to say, hey, why don't you leave this guy? This guy's a jerk or whatever. And the thing is you're not understanding why they're not leaving. A lot of that is the grooming and the brainwashing and tactics. So with this book, it's for everyone, because to understand the mind of an abuser, or why, you know, victims stay, why there's not a lot of resources. So it's really to give you a roundabout information, like, oh, this is domestic violence in its entirety.
Incredible. That is one of the most, and just to wrap up, but it just came to me and I was gonna wrap up, but then it was just the thing you talked about, why victims stay. And that is something you see in movies, something you see in TV shows, and there's something extraordinary about that. And there's kind of a grooming and a brainwashing attached to that. And I know that there's this whole, it's the last time, or it won't happen again, or I love you, and then it happens again. And it's extraordinary how someone, and even like yourself, can stay in a relationship for 10 years or so that is just downright wrong, and you're being regularly abused.
Right.
You know, it's extraordinary.
But you know, the thing is, it's also the fact is that there's not a lot of resources, you know, and the thing is, people think that the getting a restraining order is the end all be all, and it's not. Mm. And is there has to be more things in place. And so, like, when I talk about it in the book, I ask, you know, if you were in a situation where you're being victimized and you're trying to escape, you're trying to leave, what do you think you're going to need?
Yeah.
What, you know, and that's going to help you, because you may need documentation to get out of it. You may need your child's birth certificates. You may need a car that works.
Yes.
How do you get to these places if you don't have a car? And how do you get groceries?
And where do you go? Who do you speak to? Yeah.
Right.
Gosh.
So it's the reality is, so it's not just, you know, skipping, you know, 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, yeah. but, you know, it's, you're adding 3 in there, yeah. maybe 3A, 3B, yeah. you know, just to get people to understand, like, this is, it's not that victims don't want to leave, you know, the same, it's very difficult to leave, but also that it's not just a lover's quarrel. Yeah. This is a predator preying on its victim.
Yes.
That hasn't, that you don't see has been revealed.
Gosh. It's terrifying. And also, it's scary that the justice system, the judicial system, the police system often just doesn't work in favor of a matter of fact situation. There's always two sides, right, of every story. So like you're saying, right. the abuser managed to get the restraining order. Suddenly you're the criminal, right? Suddenly you're the bad right. person. But then your advisor says, well, actually, if you get one, then you're on a level playing field. You know, it's, and it's like, right. it's people from outside can't see inside. And often, I mean, there's certainly cases in the UK where the police are like, well, threatening isn't a crime. Threatening isn't, and then something awful happens. And everyone says, right. well, why didn't that person... Why didn't anyone listen to what that person was trying to tell us? So there's got to be an element of that fear as well, right? Of like, are people going right. to believe me? Are people going to believe my story? Scary.
It is. It's very scary. And that's one of the things I've said, that for one, there's a lot of scientific information that's been out here for at least 40 years that talks about this. And I said, you know, it would be amazing if the scientific information was actually in the courtroom, because yes. instead of just looking at the laws, I mean, there was a law in Arkansas that talked about it's okay to beat your wife once a month.
Oh my God.
So, you know, just because it's legal doesn't make it mean that it's right.
Yeah.
So I think that if you had scientific information, have, you know, make sure like there's a mental health, you know, professional, make sure there's scientists, neuroscientists who are brilliant in this field that understands the humanistic behaviors, you know, then the courts need to adapt, you know, to that and understand the behaviors, because
yeah.
the judges are not the ones who understand the behavior. They're only, it's only, you know, innocent until proven guilty. You have to prove
yeah.
that this person is guilty. So that means that whether it's dehumanizing, having to be re-traumatized, you know, traumatized all over again by explaining your story.
Mm.
Nobody's going over the fact that there is scientific evidence that said, hey, this person may not be right in the head.
Yep.
Maybe we should do a little more yeah. and not have him out on the street.
Wow. Well, to our listeners, you can find a link to Danielle's book on the show notes. And anywhere that Danielle cares for us to be able to find her, any social media links or websites, we'll make sure they're on the show notes as well. And I think we need to wrap up because of the time. Is there anything crucial that I've missed or anything else you'd like to plug before we wrap up?
Oh, no. I just want to thank you so much. This was amazing. I really enjoyed our time together.
Same here. The conversation's flowed and it's been an incredible episode. It really has been, and I'm sorry you went through all that stuff, and I'm just glad you're safe now and you're able to, you know, tell your story and help others, because that really is what this podcast is all about. So again, I really appreciate your time and thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.